Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 25th day of March, Anno Domini 2023, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Now, you may have noticed that 2 weeks ago, we had no Dave. Last week, we had no Steve. Last week, we had no Dave. This week, we have no Steve. I don't know what's going on around here anymore.
Well, I can report. I was out with the pneumonia, and I would have much rather have been here than at home coughing my lungs out.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. And but, Dennis, God bless him.
Yeah, filling in for us.
Yeah, here I am.
To do this, we're very excited about that.
That's right.
All right, if you rely on Netgear's Orbi Mesh wireless system to connect to the internet, you'll want to ensure it's running the latest firmware now that exploit code has been released for critical vulnerabilities in older versions. The Netgear Orbi Mesh wireless system comprises a main hub router and one or more satellite routers that extend the network's range. By setting up multiple access points in a home or office, they form a mesh system that ensures Wi-Fi coverage is available throughout. Last year, researchers on Cisco's Talos security team discovered four vulnerabilities and privately reported them to Netgear. The most severe of the vulnerabilities resides in the access control functionality of the RBR750. Hackers can exploit it to remotely execute commands by sending specially crafted requests to the device. The hacker must first connect to the device either by knowing the SSID password or by accessing an unprotected SSID. The severity of the flaw is rated 9.1 out of a possible 10. Netgear released firmware updates that patched the vulnerability in January, so update now. Two other vulnerabilities Talos discovered also received patches in January. One is also a remote command execution flaw. Its severity is rated 7.2. The other patch vulnerability has a severity rating of 6.5. It stems from the device prompting users to enter a password over an HTTP connection, which isn't encrypted. An adversary on the same network can then sniff the password. A fourth vulnerability that Talos discovered has not yet been patched. Talos released details about it anyway, in keeping with the policy of disclosing vulnerability information within 90 days of it being privately reported to the vendor. The flaw stems from hidden telnet functionality and allows adversaries to remotely execute commands. Netgear's developers previously introduced an update that removed a toggle switch in a hidden debug page that could be used to turn the telnet service off or on. The fix, unfortunately, was incomplete. As I said, three of the four vulnerabilities were patched in January. If you haven't updated your router, check your manual for instructions and do so today. If your router came from your internet provider, it's not an Orbi, so don't worry about it. And our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is patch your Orbi router immediately. And your choices are, I'm up to date, I'll do it now. Relax, I'll get to it. I don't have an Orbi router. Router? Wow, that sounded like Scooby-Doo. Router? And I don't like any of your choices, of course. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
But Orbi makes it so simple to update.
Most of them do.
Yeah. I mean, with the Orbi, it's right in the upper right-hand corner.
Right.
You can go there, and it says check for updates. It will go out to the internet, come back, and it displays a page, says, here's the version, you know, that is current, and here's the ones that should be doing it, and it'll also do it for the satellites.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's true. And it's a lot of the competitors are the same way. They either have a button in an app on your phone, or they have a button in the control panel that you use to configure. It's relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of things in computing that are not, that are thorny, but this is pretty much straightforward. And if it's out of date, oftentimes they'll put it, you know, in red or some other color that says, put a big exclamation point next to it that says, hey, it'd be a really good idea to do this. But I would add an additional item to the poll. I would add Telnet.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. But I think the thing I should have said in the poll was I should have removed the word Orbi.
Sure.
Because the reality is that it's that while this particular notice is about Orbi routers.
Routers need to be checked.
Every router needs to be checked regularly.
I would say at least every 6 months.
Oh, I would say every month. It takes a minute to log into your router and look to see if there's an update. Well, how does it hurt to do that?
All you got
to
do is put a reminder in your calendar.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, like whenever you switch the clocks, you know.
Right. but the fact is that the router is the gateway into your computer as well as your gateway out of your computer.
And one other key thing I would say, too many folks don't do it.
Yeah.
Is change the default password getting into your router. Too many folks just leave it. Oh, that's an easy one. Yeah, I'll just leave it for that. Yeah, you and now everybody else in the world knows the default password.
Or it's on a sticker on the bottom of the unit.
But yes, the default password is printed in the manual. Every human being on the planet knows what that password is. If you have a router that it didn't come from your internet service provider, if you have your own router, make sure you've changed the password. And with many of them, you cannot change the username. But you can certainly change the password. And
make it something that you don't use anywhere else.
Right. Make it unique. Make it long.
Long is great. The longer, the better.
Now, there are really two passwords we're talking about. One is the password to connect to your internet service. And the other is to log into your router, which is you do via the web.
Right. One proves to your router that you are somebody who is allowed to make changes to the settings on the router.
Right.
The other is the one that you share with people who are visiting your home so that they can connect their phones or their laptops or tablets or what have you and share your internet connection to the rest of the world.
Right. And so you really need to set both. That's an important feature and too many people...
And they should be different from each other.
And they should be unique anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So, you don't use that one anywhere else. And so that's how you protect your whole network, everything on it, every computer, laptop, phone, everything, doorbell, everything from being hacked. And that's an important thing to do. And keeping the firmware inside that router up to date. And as Dave said, they make it so easy. Just log into the web version. You know, every router has a mini little web server in it. And so you can log into that web server. That's where you put in the username and password that we want you to change.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, somewhere in that set of menus will be update the firmware. And it truly, quite literally, happens automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason they don't automate it completely is the fact that almost always when you update the firmware, it takes your network down for a minute.
And it's got to restart it.
So they don't want to do that in the middle of you doing stuff, right? So what you need to do is you schedule that by going in, like just before you go to bed and checking. So you want to do that. You want to make sure that your router firmware is up to date. You want to make sure that your router password, the password to log into the router itself, is changed from the default and is long and unique like every other of your passwords should be.
I wish they would put in a program that I could sit there and say, okay, on say every third month, please at midnight, go in, do any updates, and restart.
Right.
You know, so you could do like a scheduler.
Right.
And then just do it in the background. I mean, it's not a hard routine. And then, like you say, it's not all, they can't do it otherwise because you could be in the middle of something.
Right.
And if you were doing nightly backups or something like that, you don't want your router restarting in the middle of a backup. But if I have control of scheduling it, all right, yeah, every 3 months on a Saturday night, I don't have any backups going on. Please, at midnight, download any updates and restart it.
I have good news. This is a thing. This exists.
It does?
There are cloud-controlled devices from a company. It's a Cisco subsidiary named Meraki that has this, and also a different company named Ubiquiti that have devices that you can buy, and you configure them rather than a web page that's created by the device in your house. It is a web page that exists out at these companies' website, and you log in with an account there. You tell it what changes you want to make, and you click save. And within a minute or 2 minutes, your devices are set to go and check in with those services on the manufacturer's website and go and fetch those things.
Nice.
And
cool.
At least for the Meraki, I haven't played with Ubiquiti recently, but at least with the Meraki, I know that you can tell it, check for updates. And when updates are available, wait this many days before applying. Make sure to apply them within this window during, you know, midnight to 3 a.m. or what have you. So those things do exist. Those routers are slightly more expensive than the ones you're going to find at your local retailer. But they, if that's something that's important to you, or if you are a person who, if you're the, you know, the designated geek in your family and you're in charge of helping out your brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, parents, etc.
Or if you're running a family business.
Sure. These are devices that you can control remotely. And you don't have to drive out to their house in order to help them make changes or check on things.
Yeah.
So that's something that can be really handy and helpful.
Yep.
All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hanging in there on a gloomy Saturday in Rochester.
It's a beautiful day in my neighborhood.
But it's not snowing.
Exactly. That's it. I've got a couple questions on connecting my phone to other things. Can I use a router without having internet connection to have my, say, my phone talk to another computer?
Yes. So you have really, a router really connects two things, your internal network or your LAN.
Local area network.
Local area network. And the external network, or your WAN, the wide area network. So, for example, the other day, they were replacing the mains somewhere on Monroe Avenue and took out my internet access.
Oops.
So I could not get to the internet, but my internal network was fine. So I could still do things on one of my other machines, back up data from one to the other, et cetera, and my internal network includes my phone, so I could have done that for my phone as well.
Okay. Now I'm trying to hook up a cell phone to mirror on a smart TV.
Okay.
And I was going to try to do it with an HDMI cable, USB-C to HDMI. The TV seems to be recognizing that I'm plugging into an HDMI because it changes the order of the
inputs on the TV.
Connected devices.
Well, it says inputs, and then it's got, you know, 1, 2, 3.
Right.
Okay.
And it'll put whatever one I'm plugging into in the first position.
Okay.
So there's something going on there, but then it says there's no signal.
Okay, so there's two things. First, what kind of phone do you have?
It's an Android Samsung.
Okay. A32. What type of TV do you have?
It's a Amazon Fire.
Fire TV?
Fire TV.
Right. Fire TV.
Okay, so one of the things that you should be able to do is to what program are you trying to get to your TV?
Well, I was just going to mirror whatever I'm doing. Like if I'm working on a document or I'm working on a spreadsheet, you know, I'm using Google Docs. It would be or Google Sheets. It would be nice to be able to see it larger.
Okay.
And work with it larger. I could theoretically hook up a keyboard and mouse and I've used a mouse on my for my phone, just plugging Bluetooth, and you know that works, but you know it's still a phone's kind of tiny to see.
Right. Okay, there's a.
Everything I'm reading, everything I'm videos that I watched, people I've talked to says, "Oh, you just plug it in here and you plug it in there, and there it is." But it ain't happening.
Right.
I plug it in here and I plug it in there, and it says, "Ah, no signal."
Yeah, that.
We're doing a bunch of searching here.
Could it be the versions of the software?
Is there a different? Are there different HDMI cables that one that might have a chip in it that needs to be there, and the cheaper one isn't?
Well, Samsung does sell a line of official HDMI adapters for their phones.
Okay.
What most people tend to do is just cast the thing they're doing to their TV. But in your case, you're looking to do actual work, so I don't know that that would...
Well, yeah. There's one thing to say, I'm watching a video on my phone. Please show this video on
right, that's
my
different.
TV. That's what you were talking about, Nick.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, I could view. Now, I've been told that some, like Netflix and that, may have some sort of software to block you from doing that. But I'm looking at YouTube, or I'm looking at a website, or I'm looking, you know, like I said, working on a spreadsheet.
Okay.
You know, to have those options be a little bit larger. And it's just a temporary thing. It's not something I do a lot of every day. You know, I may do it an hour or so a week. But it would be, you know, it's not worth spending a whole lot of money on, but it's something that would be convenient if I could just plug it in and go.
All right. On the off chance that we don't come up with a great answer immediately here, do keep listening to the show, because we'll probably be investigating this during station breaks, and we'll probably have a better answer for you in the near future.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of different sites here talking about different approaches, but I want to make sure I'm grabbing something authoritative.
Yeah. It's like I said, I looked at probably at least a dozen different videos, and they show how wonderful it works, and you just get this cable. One person had a cheap eBay box that he bought that had multiple ports, and he plugged it in and was done.
Okay.
I have a HDMI cable, HDMI on one end and C on the other, that was a Amazon purchase. You know, it's fairly new.
Okay. Sometimes I'm hearing that there's a feature on the phone itself called Smart View.
Yeah, Smart View does. What Smart View does for me has it wants to hook up to a network.
Okay.
You know, make sure your router's turned on. Make sure you're and your both devices have to be hooked into the network. Well, that's one of the reasons I asked the question about the router without internet.
Uh-huh.
Right. The other thing is, on your Fire TV, have you turned on enable display mirroring?
I don't even know where I would find that.
Settings, display and audio.
Okay, I don't have it fired up, but I'll try that later.
Yeah,
okay.
What happens is you go into your settings on the TV.
Uh-huh.
You go into display and audio. One of your choices is enable display mirroring, and then there's a whole bunch of on-screen instructions to do that.
Okay.
Try that. Let us know.
All right. Yeah, well, I'll give that a shot, and then, you know, let some other callers come in, and I'll hold it. So it's display, and I have display and sounds.
Display and sounds. Audio, display and sounds.
Right, and then inside
thing.
There.
No difference.
And I'm looking at home theater.
Honest.
That's the one we know about.
Do this off screen. So it's called enable display mirroring.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
All right.
It's not easy when you've got devices that you're relying on the internet to tell you about,
right.
And it's real easy for a vendor to update the way settings are displayed, where mm-hmm. they're arranged, what they're called, what the different
same
options
thing,
are.
Just different names, just right. like Microsoft did with all their menu options.
In ye olden right. times, you would receive this bound collection of processed wood pulp that would contain images and glyphs on it from which you could divine knowledge.
Unbelievable.
And they used to even wrap it
what
in cellophane.
What sorcery is this?
Yes. And there would be an amazing thing called an index. And there would yeah. be a table that would explain to you the contents. They
and
called
then
it the
be...
table of contents.
What?
Yes, it was a magical, wonderful
what a
time.
What a world.
And you used and... to get mocked for breaking the plastic. On the...
for not breaking the plastic.
And the pictures inside looked like the pictures of the thing you were working with.
back in the days when I was doing, when I first started doing tech support at a bank, people would call up and say, how do I do this? And I would say to them, okay, because every single person had to have a manual. That was a given, right? You had to have a manual,
right?
You had to buy the actual software. Mm-hmm. So you had to have a manual.
Okay.
So I'd say, all right, if you look on page 15 of uh-huh. the manual, you will see how to do it. All right.
It's on the page after where the author thanks his spouse.
You're right. Right.
No, they had to break it out, put the manual in the binder that came with it.
Oh, right.
Undo the cellophane and pull
HP
it all
style.
Well, the real problem is we were told by management, if you go to someone's desk to help them and they do not have the documentation
mm-hmm.
and the original disks, you do not help them.
Oh, right.
Because we don't steal software. We're a bank. We don't pirate software.
Right.
Except that, of course, people do because it's cheaper than, you know, the $700 or $800.
They're also a business, and they're not.
Right. People didn't want that money on their account.
Sure.
Right. So I would often go to help somebody with a problem, see no manuals, see no disks, say, where are your original disks? Oh, wait, let me go get them. From another department?
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim came over from accounting and put it on my machine because he said it would really help me out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, Jim from accounting needs to go to jail now. Mm-hmm. That's the
for
way
piracy.
It works.
Mm,
because we well, at least...
the SPA, man. Be
disciplined.
They'll come get
you. Well, yeah. They need to be disciplined by the bank because they don't hold with that
yeah.
stuff.
Well, there was a whole... The SPA, the Software Publishers Association, was
right.
developed in almost entirely to
right.
help prosecute.
Well, see, the
piracy.
SPA doesn't mean anything to them because they think it has something to do with Lollipop Firm. But what did scare every one of them all the time was the word auditors.
Auditors, yeah. The word fine.
Because, you
yeah.
know, in a lot of companies, they say sales is king.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. In a bank, the auditors are king.
Mm-hmm.
And if we would say to them, I have to tell this to the auditors, I'll buy it tomorrow.
Right.
Okay.
The best line, though, was always for auditors, come in and say, we're here to help you.
We're here to help.
That's one that my late wife was an auditor for yep. Kodak. And she used to say they get more chuckles out of the people, you know, because they come over there, the whole team, and we're here to help you.
Yep.
Most of them are sitting there shaking their head. Oh, mm-hmm. hell no.
You're right. But that's a thing that you've got to be aware of. You know, we've got people who still steal software, and that's your choice. But I personally don't like helping people who are stealing software.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Dennis Worster, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here. On member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites.
Ta-da.
And you, what?
Ta-da.
And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And I'll read the news while you do. Hackers are actively exploiting a critical escalation of privilege vulnerability in Outlook, according to Microsoft.
Oh, yeah.
If you use Outlook on Windows, or I suppose anywhere, you need to update the email client today. Large organizations must consult Microsoft instructions to quickly mitigate this threat. This zero-day vulnerability is rated 9.8 out of 10.
Ooh, they're getting better.
Yep, meaning that it is both dangerous and easy to exploit. Details are a bit slim. There's a surprise. But Microsoft explains that a specially crafted email automatically triggers the exploit when it's received by Outlook without any interaction from the user.
Amazing.
So all it has to do is come to your mailbox.
Fun.
Yeah. The exploit allows a hacker to access the victim's NTLM V2 hash. From there, the hacker can gain access to the victim's network for further attacks or observation.
So that's probably, what, NT LAN Manager?
NT LAN Manager version 2.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Okay. Russia-based threat actor has already utilized this exploit to target organizations in government, transportation, energy, and military sectors in Europe. Notably, the vulnerability was first recognized and reported by Ukraine's CERT security response team. But, of course, once it's out there in the wild, then the script titties are going to use it to get at everybody. A patch for this vulnerability is available in the latest Outlook update. I suggest that you manually update Outlook immediately for all Windows PCs in your home. To update Outlook, simply press the File tab thing. Select Microsoft Account from the pop-out menu. Click Update Options and choose Update Now. Large organizations may have a difficult time updating all instances of Outlook. For this reason, Microsoft lists several mitigation methods on its CVE listing. Microsoft also offers a PowerShell script that allows organizations to see if they've been targeted by this vulnerability. So, do you use Outlook? Why? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
I think a lot of folks, though, have moved away from that, Outlook and that, because it's always got so many holes. I mean, Microsoft is known for, not updating stuff in a timely manner, that, they've just lost faith in that. It's just like their Internet Explorer. A lot of folks don't care for that because of all the other junk that you wind up getting in with it.
Right. Well, yeah, they switched over to Edge a while ago, and I'd say for Outlook, it tends to be businesses primarily. Any place where you need to keep track of who you're talking to.
Calendars, and
keeping track of your active projects and when your next meeting is. These are all things that Outlook does really well, and integrating that, especially with Microsoft Teams and doing video calls, especially now that people are working from home. It's become a more common tool in larger organizations, I'd say higher ed and businesses in general. It's kind of it was the go-to. It was the easy choice for admins to make, to have your own Exchange server on site. And Outlook was a client that worked really well with Exchange server environments. So it makes sense to me. And for people who are Microsoft 365 for Business subscribers, this is kind of the standard choice. And truth be told, even some of the Apple products, which have gotten much, much, much better, are still not 100% when they're working with Microsoft-backed servers. It's a tricky thing to get right. And when the vendor is changing things behind the scenes and not necessarily updating people about other developers about what they're changing and when, it can be tricky to keep that working properly.
Especially I know from my experience, their Microsoft Access database.
Mm-hmm.
They're making changes to that, and then those changes, because if you do the updates,
right,
all of a sudden you go to run this a couple of your programs, and now they're not working right because it changed things around
right
on the internal part that no longer now the program works correctly.
Right.
And it's causing a lot of companies to sit there and say, the heck with that, and they're moving away from that.
Sure, many of them are moving to one of the various SQLs.
Yeah, SQL is super.
Well, the big thing about SQL is because whatever version, whether it's light or any one of the dozens of variants, the thing about SQL is it doesn't matter what the internals are. Because what happens is you send it a command.
Yeah, queries.
And
definitely.
Then it interprets that query or command and sends you back the results. So it doesn't matter what the internals look like.
Right, right. As long as you interact with it the same way.
Right, right. And so they can change the back end anytime they want, as often as they want, without having any impact whatsoever on the front end, the commands that you enter, the query that you send it. Select star from whatever. So.
Well, and that allows you to create situations where you've got a lot more scale, so you can handle a lot more load from many different people simultaneously.
Exactly.
And you can also scale up the storage. So if you have databases that are likely to grow quickly, you can make sure to handle the capacity. So it's not just about access speed, but it's about how much can you store and how quickly can you do it.
Right. Right.
So when you can scale and scope those things to be appropriately sized for whatever you're about to do next, then the method by how that's happening, it's okay to abstract that away as long as you can still issue the same types of commands, the same types of queries, and get reasonable results back that you can process.
Right. And before we get back to the phones, we had somebody in the chat, the doctor, said yes, but how many people steal the lame software for the Linux installation? So they can listen to MP3s. LAME is LGPL, so it is unencumbered mostly. So you can install it without a problem. And MP3s have been free for
decades.
A decade anyway. They used to be, yes, MP3 was a proprietary compression format for audio.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was at least a decade ago that they
decade and a half at least.
Maybe. But anyway, at least a decade. At the very least.
Oh, yeah.
We had an internet where we could look up these things.
Exactly. So MP3 is also free. So you're not stealing anything. It's very difficult to steal free stuff when they just let you take it.
They can try.
That's fine the way it is. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim. From Irondequoit, New York. Jim, what's up?
I've been listening to you for quite a while, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you left me with the impression that I shouldn't upgrade to Windows 11. And I just wonder if you still feel that way, or, I keep getting the notices to update, and I haven't based on what I think you've said. So I'm sort of... in a dilemma whether I should update to Windows 11 or not.
Well,
how old's your machine?
Yeah, that's the big thing is how fast is your machine? How old is your machine? How much RAM do you have?
Well, I've got three or four different. I've got new ones that are a year old, and I've got laptops that are three, and I've got towers that are maybe 10 or so.
Well, yeah. All right. The year-old one, you probably should. I mean, if you've got 4 gigs of RAM, at least 8 is better, but 4 gigs of RAM and a fast hard drive and a fast processor, then yes, you should upgrade to Windows 11. If you have less than 4 gigs of RAM, or if your processor is really slow, or if your machine is so old that it has a lot of trouble booting up Windows 10, then no, you should not upgrade to 11.
Anything over 4 to 5 years old, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
Okay, then I'll update it on my newest machine.
There you go.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And our reasoning is that, you will have a really terrible experience on a very old machine trying to go to Windows 11 because it assumes a lot of processing power and a lot of RAM and a lot of disk space. But the other thing is you just have no guarantee that every piece of hardware in that machine is going to have a driver in Windows 11.
Mm-hmm. Now, do they still have that Windows?
You should turn your mic on.
You know, it works better when you turn the mic on.
It does, doesn't it?
Hey, this is so much better.
Unbelievable.
Of course, now I have to cough, but such is radio, right? So does Microsoft still put out that Windows Experience Index where you can see how well your machine is behaving and then it will have an advisor?
I do not know.
I remember that they were trying that, I think maybe for Windows 10 or Windows 7. That it was something you could run, and they'd give your different systems, your storage system, your CPU, graphics subsystem, et cetera, a score. And you could use that score to say, this looks fine. You should be able to go with no problem. Or, hey, you know, you might have, you'd be able to do it, but you're going to have a diminished experience compared to what's possible. Or definitely low enough that the graphs go orange and red, and they say, yeah, you probably don't want to. You could do it, but you're not going to be happy about it.
Yeah, that's gone.
Okay.
The Windows Index Experience Index is gone as a graphical tool.
I see.
There is still the WinSAT, the Windows System Assessment Tool.
Oh, okay.
Windows System Assessment Tool. Mm-hmm. That is now a command line program that saves to an XML file. So maybe not something the average user should be running.
Great.
But it does, that part of it still exists.
I wonder if there are any third parties that will make use of that command line tool and the XML and then display it.
Maybe. We'll have to take a look at that at some point.
Opportunity for developers there to
enhance
what's possible.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Sherry from Rochester, New York. What's up, Sherry?
Hi, I have two questions, small ones. First of all, are you still accepting text messages to your program?
We are not. We have way too much to do here. It's you know, if on a regular show, when it's just a DJ sitting in front of a board, they can watch the text messages and do everything else. But poor Dave is already having enough trouble with the board and answering the phones and trying to figure out on a daily basis what his breathing and everything else. we don't do that.
Not a problem.
Blink, Dave, blink.
But we do have a chat. We do have a chat page.
Okay.
So if you go to soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, and under you scroll down to some important links. The very first one is the Soundbites chat. And during the show, you'll be able to leave a chat message there, and we do try to watch that regularly.
All right, thanks. All right, my next question, you just talked about Outlook.
Yes.
And you should update it. Well, I'm still using Outlook 2013.
Mm.
Is there any chance that can get updated? Do you know?
Unlikely. Generally speaking, when it's that old, and that's 10 years ago, when you were still in high school, Sherry. That particular version is not updatable to the latest. You would have to get the new version.
I guess I better stop using it then.
Well, it's probably not a good idea to keep using it.
If it were a person, it would be a fourth grader by now.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I talked to you a week or two ago about the Chromebook and that I just got. And, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, transition everything over from Windows. You know, I'm just trying to figure out the best way to save my emails, you know, instead of keep them, you know, in the Gmail account. So,
well, keeping them in the Gmail account is not a bad thing to do, actually.
Well, I get a lot. So,
okay.
I mean, the Outlook file is humongous. You know, I got to clean it up. But,
well,
you know,
if you're on Gmail, check Gmail via the web. It's possible that all your mail is still there in the Gmail account.
Yeah, it is. That's my main account, Gmail. Mm-hmm. But I had it, you know, going through Outlook, so I could. I was just on Outlook, okay. And mm-hmm. when
right.
I started using Gmail, I just continued using Outlook with it. You know, and I save emails and folders and things like that. So, yeah, I'm trying to figure out the best way to keep folders, but not in Outlook, you know.
So you've looked at the Gmail account on the web, and you see that those folders aren't there, and the mail isn't there either?
No, I had my folders in Outlook. I never kept any folders in Gmail.
But what I'm saying is they may have been mirrored to Gmail, so they may already be there. You should go look.
I've looked.
Okay.
And they're not there that okay. I see.
Okay.
So,
all right. That's all I was asking. Just
yeah.
checking that. Right. Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, the best way to keep folders of emails, you know, transition them over on a desktop or something or a folder.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out. But one last question that I think about it. So now that I have this Chromebook and I'm trying to figure that out, and there's a hard drive on it, I don't know, mm-hmm. 200 gigabytes or something.
Okay.
Does Chrome or whoever operates Chrome, do they have access to your hard drive?
No.
No?
No. Your hard drive itself is the only person who has access to it. Unless, of course, you purposely run software that gives someone else access. But normally speaking, no one else has access to your hard drive on a Chromebook except you.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess I got some work to do to get rid of Outlook now that you mentioned this.
Well, it is yes, you probably should. You're not in a huge hurry, but you should
take
be working
your time,
on it.
But do it.
Yeah, you should be working on it. You should be able to export. It also depends on what you want to use on the Chromebook itself. The best thing to do in the long run is to on a Chromebook is to use the web interface. Now that's another thought. If you log on to Microsoft. On the web, what is it called? 365?
Yeah, outlook.microsoft.com. We'll get you there.
Yeah, outlook.microsoft.com and log in with your same credentials. If you can, take a look and see if your stuff is there.
What do you mean, for Outlook?
Yeah.
Huh, well, I told you it's a 2013 Outlook program.
Yeah, they're probably not there, but you can... you can use, that's interesting. It says the connection Outlook is not secure.
Yeah, I'll just stop using it. You know, I mean, I can look at all my mail and Gmail and, you know, save stuff to a hard drive somewhere, you know.
Okay. Right, like, right.
Make a PST file.
The old
right.
adage applies here, you know, how do you eat an elephant?
One bite
at a time and just, you know, take a little bit at a time. Don't let it overwhelm you. Just each day, you know, make right. a list and take one little hunk
yep.
and work on it.
Chip
and
away at
slowly
it.
It'll yep. chip away and you'll be clear of it.
The other right, thing right. to think about at some point is mail that you don't need anymore that you've just been saving.
Yeah.
You laugh. I'm the same way. I've got email from like 1980.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. If I don't need it anymore, one
and
thing...
And you criticize me about my tabs?
Yeah,
you were carrying stuff from 1980?
Except that's at my old work address, which they let me keep.
Hang on.
And the statute of limitations hasn't run out
keep
on some of those
Dave.
Things.
Keep breathing.
He's going to kill me.
You never know what you might need.
That's
no?
right. But oh, some of that stuff you might think... about downloading and archiving off to a thumb drive.
I know. I'm doing it. Okay.
That's good.
To go through, okay, and deleting stuff. I'm doing it, okay? It's just, you know.
Hey, we're cheering for you.
Faster.
We're cheering for you.
I don't want to hear
You're
anything
putting
more
in.
About my tabs.
There's a difference.
The oldest emails I have are probably maybe 2-3 years old.
There's no, that's a false equivalency.
No.
Your 500 tabs in my old email that just sits out on a server somewhere. All right, thank you, Sherry, for getting me in trouble.
Okay.
Not even close.
Call back next
time. Thank you, Sherry.
Thanks.
Call again.
Okay.
Bye.
All right, bye.
She just made my day.
Well, good for you.
That's nice.
Fine.
Yeah.
1980. That's older than we've been on this show.
Yes. I have emails.
He's OG.
I'm OG, man.
There's got to be so much dust on it. It'd probably choke a horse.
The headers were much smaller back then.
I will be quite real and say that much of that is emails from old friends who have passed that I do not want to get rid of. So, but you know, as long as they let me, and I backed it all up,
of course.
But as long as they let me keep the space, I will keep those emails. And so, but yes, you should. In any case, whoever you are out there, you should have backups of your important emails. And it's easy enough to download email from any email client. Just generally, it's under File Export. And you pick what you want to download, download it to a file, throw it on a thumb drive, and put it away somewhere. It's real easy to do. It doesn't take a lot of your time. And we've seen over the years a lot of errors in online email programs and local email programs. We've seen companies go out of business. We've seen companies limit the amount of email you can have. And I get that. But, you know, if you don't want to lose those emails, you back them up yourself. That's take personal responsibility. Back them up. Get them somewhere safe for you. That's a thing you should always remember to do. And again, that, you know, we hate to say it, but you're your own systems administrator now. The days of I just run my own machine, those are gone.
Yeah,
you're a systems administrator. You've got a network to run. You've got mail to back up. You've got all kinds of things that have to be done. You should be backing up all the time. You should be backing up in multiple places. And you should be backing up everything, not just your documents and your pictures, but your email and all of that stuff. If you write programs, your programs, all kinds of things. Back up, back up, back up. And because someday you're going to lose something you really actually wanted to keep. And that's a sad day.
Well, and I'll go one step further. It's okay to be backing up. Backing up is a very important step. But the thing that counts the most is being able to restore from the backup.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Periodically check it.
Once in a while, pretend like you now have a need to restore from that backup. Let's work through how would somebody do that if they wanted to.
Right, we can do that. All right, but right now, that music tells us you have wasted an entire hour of your life with this nonsense. But do not go away, because you lucky people, there's an entire another hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. That's right. A whole nother hour of Dave Enright, a whole nother hour of Dennis Worster, a whole nother hour of Nick Francesco, and a whole nother hour of you with your calls and your chat. You are listening to Sound Bites right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you, because with your generous support, we remain solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. Take a quick, not a quick break. This is the longer break, so take a bio break, get yourself a beverage, but come on back for the next hour of Sound Bites right here on Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1, turn your radio down. 2, turn your radio down lower. 3, remember, nobody has invented a good sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4, make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5, calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Soundbites, on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That must mean it's Soundbites.
Yeah.
Right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
One question, and probably a lot
I'm sorry, we don't take questions.
No, not this week.
Maybe next week?
Yeah, all right, go ahead. One question.
Okay, just the one.
No, I'm sure a lot of folks are wondering our views, though, on TikTok.
What is our view on TikTok?
Is our view on TikTok?
Well, I can understand. It seems like right now they're going big time as far as promoting it that much more. Because they're, like anything else, the internet, even the internet, there's the good side to it and there's the bad side to it.
Sure.
And right now, I guess even the actual owner of it, had, before the committee there, he said, well, you know, we can bring that server and put it right here in the U.S.
Right.
And set it up and, you know, have full control and all that. So this is kind of like a double-edged sword in that, you know, it cuts both ways and that, you know, it does serve a lot of goods. Kids do have fun with it.
Sure.
They, just like they did with Facebook and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, it can go, it can cut both ways.
Right. Before we go on with that, let me read the actual news item.
Yes.
So we know what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to.
For nearly 5 hours on Thursday, Congress members of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce grilled TikTok CEO Xu Zhi Chu. I beg your pardon.
No, there you go. You got it.
Over concerns about the platform's risk to safety of minors, data privacy, and national security for American users. In his testimony, Chu defended TikTok's $1.5 billion solution to these concerns, Project Texas, which he said would ensure TikTok data is behind a U.S. firewall and out of China's reach as a more appropriate measure than forcing a sale of TikTok from its owner, China-controlled ByteDance, or banning TikTok in the U.S. Chu said that with Project Texas, TikTok was launching an unprecedented effort to be more transparent about its algorithm and data collection than any other big tech company. American companies don't have a good track record with data privacy, Chu reminded the committee, while repeatedly telling Congress members that the questions that they had about TikTok reflected industry-wide problems that go well beyond one app. Chu also said that he's seen no evidence that Project Texas doesn't address Congress' national security concerns. However, he refused to comment on a whistleblower report from Tech Workers Coalition, where a TikTok content moderator confirmed one of Congress's worst suspicions that ByteDance has access to user data that could be used to track and spy on Americans. Things got personal for Chu, who lives in Singapore, not China, when Congress members pressured him to disclose his own connections to the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party CCP, which he repeatedly evaded. He reminded the committee that his testimonies were exclusively about TikTok. He also consistently resisted responding to several committee members asking to be condemned Chinese human rights abuses against the Turkish ethnic minority in China, the Uyghurs. Nothing that Chu said seemed to weaken the bipartisan united front against TikTok that was presented by committee members. During the hearing, Congress members referenced various bills that could force TikTok to change how it operates. Some members asked Chu if TikTok would commit to meeting their bill's requirements before laws were passed. For the most part, Chu evaded these requests. Where does it go from here? According to the chairperson of the committee, a data privacy bill is the only way to stop TikTok, and a ban could only be a short-term solution. So, does someone you know use TikTok? Give us a call, but not on that phone. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, I saw the story, and that's why I wanted to get in. Because, you know, I've got younger grandkids.
Yep.
And, you know, they were asking about it and that. And they go, because they've got so many friends and they do so much other stuff, you know, and keeping in contact with it and that. And they're saying, you know, with all the other junk there on Facebook and that, I got two of my granddaughters, you know, don't even want Facebook now. because there's so much junk in there on it that they can sit there with their TikTok and then and share stuff with their friends in there that they went to school with and everything else.
But here's the real problem with TikTok is the fact that it's on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that, you know, every day, these days, everybody keeps everything on their phone. And does TikTok have access to all of that? And can they put something on your phone that gives them access to all of that? And lots of kids buy tokens in TikTok, which means that their financial information is now in TikTok.
See, I don't use it, so they gave me the whole lesson in forming on it.
Right,
so it's
right.
Like, whoa, but which brings up that good point.
Right, and so what the United States is saying is that this is owned by the Chinese government, who is not our friend.
Right.
They've said they are not our friend. So that's not my opinion.
That's China's opinion.
So, yeah, the national security law in China requires companies to turn over customer data if requested by Beijing.
Right. So they have no choice but to do that. And that means that your child's information is open to the Chinese government anytime they ask for it. That's simply the fact.
Oh, that's scary. Well, just like we've said, when these kids go online back with the Facebook days and posting stuff and all the stupid stuff they did in college and all that, and now while they're going for job interviews,
yeah,
all the stuff that they did back then is coming to bite them in the butt.
Right.
And I'm afraid this is going to be the same thing, too. And that's why I was telling both of them, you know, you got to use discretion. And especially with your personal information, protect it.
Or with your body. Let's face it, there are a lot of pictures on TikTok that maybe shouldn't be there.
See,
they're there, trust me. And the reality is that, let's say you're a 16, 14-year-old girl, and you put a picture out there for your boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And it's private, and only your boyfriend sees it. Now you get a job in the State Department 10 years later. Suddenly somebody from China comes to you and says, look what I got.
Yeah, sure it'd be a shame if that got spread around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And
we don't know that cannot happen.
Yep.
And that's the point behind this.
Yeah, and that's the scary part, though. You know, it's like, the internet was created for good. Actually, back in the military.
Right.
The military. And you're going to have both sides. Like I said, it's like a knife. It cuts both ways.
Right.
People can use it for good. I mean, look at right now, folks. You can have medical conditions, say, and a doctor can sit there and share your information with other doctors across the country and formulate, you know, assessments on you. Viewing their test results, x-rays, and everything else, because everything has gone electronic. They don't do old x-rays anymore. It's all electronic.
But the other side of that two-edged sword
is
that if you go for a new job, they look at your record and say, oh, we can't cover this because it's a pre-existing condition.
Yep. Oh, yeah. It cuts definitely both ways. Right. And I just found it very interesting. Of course, and again, I don't like talking into politics, but when they go off on these other tangents, you know, somebody's beliefs or that type of stuff. No, stay on the subject.
Right.
That's what you should be sticking to, not this other side roads. But again, yes, there need to be concerns. There probably should put some guardrails up in place. It would probably be better if the server was here for our information.
Well, assuming that the data still don't get to China, and we don't know that it won't. But I will say that it does kind of hearten me to see that even in these divisive times, this whole TikTok thing is solidly bipartisan. Both sides are united about this, and that's a nice thing to see.
And some of them couldn't even pronounce it.
Well, TikTok. and that's part of the problem.
I thought that was funny.
Most of those people don't have any idea what TikTok is.
Right. They're advised by staffers that are
well, they probably gave them a
30-second.
Yeah.
Or gave them a 30-second. Here's what Right. Oh, okay.
Right. But yeah, but I think that there's definitely a case to be made that there should be more information and more regulation around data brokers in general. Now, take that information and what they do with it and who they talk to and who they're
talking to. That's been the problem with Facebook and TikTok and Twitter. You know, they're putting out so much information out there that you think, oh, no, well, it's like we've said before, oh, I don't have anything worthwhile. You'd be surprised just having the identity that then somebody could sit there and then open up four or five credit cards.
Right.
I remember seeing a report. I think this was about, it's got to be about 15 years ago, that the government agency opened up three credit cards. And they were for small amounts, only a couple thousand dollars. And they put out there through the black web that this one guy had, he put up one first to see how fast they could deplete it. That took maybe about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Once these black market folks saw that this guy was viable, he put out two more credit cards. Both with $2,000 on it. Both of them were depleted in five minutes or less.
Yep.
And we say, well, what do you mean? They took these credit cards out in somebody's name, which holds them accountable for it. Hopefully nowadays, not as much. And they bought stuff and had it, even though it was their card, shipped to some address, say, in South Africa, Turkey, or somewhere else, and then resold it and got cash out of it.
Right.
So, you know, they're buying, you know, these iPads and everything else and making money on it.
I used to say that to my students. They'd say the same thing. I don't have anything anybody wants to steal. You have a large computer on fast computer on the fastest network in Western New York, first. Secondly, you have pristine credit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pristine credit. That is the gold prize right there.
Yep.
Or even if your credit is bad, you've still got credit.
Yeah. Oh, and you live in a modern Western country and have access to a network that's connected to all the other places on the planet. So even if they're not stealing from you, they can legitimately connect to your device and use it as a launching point for other targeted attacks.
Well, like you said, though, even though you might not have the best credit, you can have pretty crappy credit, and you'll still find some lenders that'll sit there and still give you a card maybe for $1,000, but you're paying a high interest rate.
And they don't care what the interest rate is.
Scammers don't care. Go ahead. Double that if you want. I'm not going to pay it.
Right.
And they, get the cards and, maybe have 20% interest or whatever. They don't care. They just want to quick deplete that card of any money that's on it and then go on to the next one. And they're making money on that big time.
Yep. Yep. It's an important thing for you to understand that there is a real benefit to keeping your stuff as secure as possible, and benefits that you don't even think about. Like we said, is somebody interested in your personal checking account amount? Probably not. Are they interested in whatever money you have? Yes, they are. Are they interested in your credit rating? Yes, they are.
Oh, most definitely they're.
If they get enough information to open a line of credit somewhere else, open a bank account somewhere else, great.
Mm-hmm.
They may only use that bank account to siphon funds from somebody else, move it from there to that account and that account to somewhere else and somewhere else and somewhere else. But you're now in that chain. That's your name in that chain.
Yep, shuffling it around.
Yep, and so while they're money laundering. So you need to be aware. And you need to protect yourself. And it's not really difficult to do, but you have to do it.
Discretion. And again, the other key thing is, like we've said before, is passwords. We can't stress enough how passwords need to be complicated. Now, you don't have to memorize them. There's plenty of programs that will keep track of that for you. And it, all it does, bottom line, is keep you safe. So you don't get these notices from banks and that, oh, your account has been hacked or this or that. Because if you're using strong passwords, they're not going to get hacked.
What can you tell me about hardware tokens like YubiKey or something else when it comes to security?
Okay, so 2FA, two-factor authentication. It's something you know, your password, mm-hmm. your username and password.
Okay.
And something you have, like these little hardware keys.
Right.
So what happens is when you set up a system, you hook it to that particular key.
Okay.
And those change the password in them every whatever.
Okay.
Seconds. 1 second, 10 seconds, whatever it is. And what they will ask you to do is run a specific program on your computer, which identifies the type of key you have mm-hmm. and therefore knows what algorithm it is and all of that stuff.
Right.
And checks the hash. And so it will then say, okay, plug your key in. You plug your key into USB. It reads the current password,
mm-hmm.
which is going to change in another 10 seconds or whatever.
Right.
But it reads the current password, and then it checks that against the known hash that it has. And then it says, okay, it doesn't know the password, but it knows what the hash is going to be.
Uh-huh.
And checks the hash.
Right.
So if somebody tries to create the password without the right hash, it's not going to work. So it checks that to say, okay, you are the person who has both your password and your key.
Right.
So the theory is you're Dennis Worcester.
Okay. Now, some of these I've seen have physical connections, like a USB-C.
Right.
Or even some that have a lightning port to plug right. into your Apple devices. And lots of them also have NFC so that you can wirelessly right. talk to them from a device. And most of the videos I've been watching are related to setting up things with your phone and then bringing your token close to your phone so that they can talk to each other. Your phone can talk to the token and back and forth without a physical connection. And it sounds like these are relatively inexpensive. You know, they're way less than $50 and probably closer to 20 or 30.
Right.
Per. The people I've been listening to say the systems they've been working with say that you must set up two different tokens, and then, you know, you take one at home and put it in your safe, and you have the other one on your keychain or nearby or in a desk drawer or wherever you're likely to use it. And they said as long as you don't lose all of your tokens, you're going to be fine. But it's really important that you create at least one more than you plan on using so that if something happens and right. it becomes destroyed or thrown right. in the river or in a house fire or whatever, that you're still covered.
That's like a PGP, pretty good protection, the uh-huh. encryption standard.
Right.
Where you create a public key
mm-hmm.
and a private key.
Yes, and you publish the public one.
You publish the public one, and the private key only, the public key will only decrypt stuff encrypted by the private key.
Right.
So if I send you something encrypted, and you can decrypt it with my public key, then the theory is it was created with my private key.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is only I have my private key.
Right.
And it's similar to what happens with these devices.
Okay. So instead of
without getting into the weeds.
Yeah, so instead of the private key, you have a physical device that you can secure physically rather than something you'd type in.
Right. Right.
Or something you'd keep on the computer itself.
Right. So, right. And that's very similar to what happens with the authenticators you can load on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Google has one.
Yep.
Facebook,
Microsoft, yeah.
Microsoft, everybody's got one. So the basic idea is that you read off the current code mm-hmm. on your authenticator, type it into your computer.
Yeah, 6 digits or whatever.
Right. And that then is exactly the same thing as these keys.
These fobs, yeah.
The code changes regularly. The algorithm knows what that code is going to be,
mm-hmm.
or the hash of that code, actually.
Right.
And so it can say, all right, you got this right.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably you.
Now, there was a situation 10 years ago, maybe, where PayPal was offering to send you an RSA key.
Who was?
PayPal.
Oh, PayPal, yeah.
They were offering to send you an RSA key. It looked like a little football shape. It was gray. It had a button on it and a display that would show you six digits. And those digits would change roughly once a minute or so. And you would log into your computer and you'd put those digits after your password. You'd append those digits to your password. So you'd submit that. They, again, knew what digits to be expecting. They ran a hash on it. Everything looked cool. And they'd let you in. Later on, 18 months, I'm estimating, or so later, they were told, oh, by the way, the algorithm stored inside the chip on those devices has been compromised.
Yep.
People are able to predict what the next set of keys are likely to be, and therefore this device and this approach is really no more secure than the password originally.
Right.
Are you aware of how these algorithms have progressed in the meantime?
Significantly.
Is this anything that people should be concerned about day to day?
Less so. The thing is, okay, so I personally believe that the authenticators on your phone are better than the hardware keys.
Okay. Why do you think that?
Because the hardware keys are set in time.
Mm-hmm.
They use the best known algorithm for that time.
Yeah.
Well, this is the internet. And this is computers.
Right.
Those internets get better and better and better all the time.
Right.
So if you've got a... are you all right there?
You know, there is a built-in screen reader on macOS called VoiceOver.
Yeah.
And when you set up a new computer and it restarts, it makes sure to tell you this.
How nice of it.
Isn't that nice?
It's very
sweet. The
problem
is, when you're on the radio,
yeah.
You might not want that to go out there.
Well, that's one thing.
And closing the lid doesn't stop it.
Doesn't stop it.
Well, you were saying about security keys.
About security keys. The ones that you get are set in time. They use the best algorithm they could at that moment.
And they bake it into the chip.
Whereas the one on your phone can get updated as new algorithms come out, as problems in the algorithm vulnerabilities are discovered and they fix them,
right?
They can update the one on your phone. So I personally much prefer the updatable ones to the not updatable ones.
Okay, so now, the physical ones are a point in time.
Right,
they're great, they're convenient, but you should plan that they are likely to go, shall we say, at some point. And it's up to you to keep track of what are the stats on these, and is that still enough security for you?
Right, right, right. Whereas you can generally figure that from the larger companies, Microsoft, Google, Apple, the authenticators on your phone will be updated regularly to the latest security features.
Are the devices that are not using NFC and that have a physical connection, like a USB-C or a Lightning adapter, updatable on the inside?
Some of them are.
Okay.
Not all of them.
All right. So that would be something to check for when you do evaluate the different options.
Right.
Because there are half a dozen different companies or more that make these.
Right.
And we might expect that some of the less expensive ones may not have that capability.
Right.
Okay.
So, I would say using two-factor authentication in whatever form, the least expensive form is send me a text message.
Sure.
With a code, and I put that code in.
Right.
Those are not terribly secure because we all know how easy it is to intercept text messages. But they're still pretty secure because there's a timing issue. You know, you'd have to be watching that particular website and my phone to get my code in time to beat me to putting it in.
Right.
So still pretty secure. And so that's more of a problem for high profile targets.
Right.
So for, you know, the general run of the mill, that's good enough.
Okay.
But if you really want high end, then you use an authenticator.
Got it.
All right. We've got somebody in the line, but we'll get to them after the break. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Jerome from Rochester, and you. It is, 29 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites. This is member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm still Dennis Worcester.
Still?
Yeah, it's working out.
No Steve Ray this week.
No Steve Ray. At 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And I do want to apologize to Dennis for calling him Steve at the end of the last break.
Well,
an insult
Steve's
to
great.
Both of you.
No, Steve's a great guy.
I think you did mention Dennis, but you also threw Steve's
We'll have to go check the podcast.
Yeah, we'll have to.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jerome from Rochester, New York. What's up, Jerome?
Hey, guys. You were chatting about TikTok recently, and thought I would just ask a question about Facebook.
Okay.
Now, Facebook, I know, likes to follow people around the network, and I have, for social reasons, been forced to actually use Facebook recently. But I've tried to use it in the private mode, the private window from Firefox. So how effective is that in at least creating problems for Facebook following me around the web?
It may not do everything you'd like it to do. The private mode on browsers was really designed for one specific purpose, and that was basically to keep the places you're going out of your browser history more than anything else. What else do we know about that, Nick?
That's pretty much the reason it was done. Now, what you should do is there is an add-on for Firefox called Facebook Fence. And what that does is it creates a literal fence around Facebook's data. So that when you are on Facebook, it's all available to Facebook. But when you leave Facebook, Facebook can't see other people. Other places you go.
Interesting.
Now,
there's also a Facebook container for Firefox.
Right. Maybe that's what it's called, Facebook. I thought it was called Fence, but maybe it's container.
Okay.
Anyway, the other point is it seems like every website on the stinking planet has a Facebook, what they call a Facebook bug in it. And that's a tiny little bit of code. You often see Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all those things where you can click a button. Well, what each of those is actually doing is connecting back to that application. So Facebook knows already you went to that page. And if you manage to hide yourself so that it doesn't know it was you, there's still an amazing amount of data that your browser sends that can fingerprint you. You'd be astounded at how accurately they can tell who you are and where you've been. And then if you click on that button to say, oh, I want to put that on Facebook, well, now you're just giving them even more information.
Wouldn't like DuckDuckGo be better?
If you're using a browser like DuckDuckGo, it eliminates much of that stuff. But that would be instead of Firefox, you would use DuckDuckGo. And that has one of the things that DuckDuckGo is all about is privacy. And so they tend at least to try to strip out all of those trackers from every website you go to.
So since you're, trying to limit your use and having them try to track you, use Firefox for, everything else, but use DuckDuckGo to do your Facebook stuff.
Right. What I do is use a different browser for Facebook than I do for everything else.
Okay.
And that helps limit because it can't read any of the data. They use what are called super cookies, which means they can read other people's cookies on your machine. But if it's in a different browser where I don't go anywhere but to Facebook, then all it's reading is stuff it already knows about me.
Right. Nothing that juicy to find out.
Nothing juicy to find. Well, that's my life anyway. Even so.
Sorry to disappoint them, but.
You're right, exactly. Or me. But that's the thing we recommend to people is that you use a different browser for Facebook and only for Facebook.
Interesting.
How about erasing footsteps?
You can't. Once they're on the web, they're out there, and there is no guarantee you will ever get them gone.
Yeah, because you never know where it went.
Right.
It's called the World Wide Web.
Sorry, what?
They've got what they've got, but how can I keep them from, you know, getting more?
Well, if it's on your machine, sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, can you guys post the contents of this on a note on your Soundbites webpage?
We'd have to put that together. There isn't one that I know of immediately, but I'll work on it. The thing is, right now, the best thing to do is to use a separate browser for Facebook.
Solely for Facebook.
Solely for Facebook. You know, even if you have to download a different one. You know, there's 50 of them out there. So find one that you don't use for anything else and use that for Facebook alone. And that will help at least protect you.
Okay.
That'd be the easiest and most likely to be helpful.
How about, let me ask this question. Let's say I have two different machines, and I've only used Facebook on one machine. Am I relatively immune from Facebook tracking on the other machine?
Yes.
Following the account?
Yes and no. I mean, look, the reality is that the way the algorithms work these days, they will eventually figure out you no matter what machine you use, no matter what browser you use. But you can make it hard for them by doing what you're doing, is use Facebook on one machine and everything else on another machine.
Neat. Okay, thank you, guys.
Yep.
That's helpful.
Thanks.
Right. Thanks, Jerome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, the reality is that there's just... The algorithms are getting too good.
Right.
They can figure out who you are and where you've been and where you're going, even if you use a completely different machine, as Jerome is doing. So, but it makes it harder for them, and it's not always as accurate. And I suppose that's something.
It's a start.
It's a start. All you can do is.
It's an arms race, really.
Yeah, exactly.
The problem is they have billions of dollars.
Right. Right.
And an incentive to want to do the things they're doing.
Right.
They have nothing else to do. This is their job.
This is their job, as a matter of fact. This is with their livelihood.
Exactly.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. What's up, Mark?
Hi, Nick. I was just listening to what the gentleman had to say about Facebook, and if he likes Firefox and he doesn't care about saving cookies from anything, Firefox offers their private browser that's, you don't have to use a private tab. You just use the whole browser. It saves nothing. And he could use that to browse Facebook on top of using the add-on you suggested.
Right, right. Again, though, that private browser is designed to keep data off of your machine, not away from...
Exactly, but it's like I said, if he's familiar with Firefox, he could use that instead of Firefox.
Will it do what he's hoping for?
I don't think it keeps things in a separate container, though.
Mm-mm. As far as I know, it does.
Oh, all right.
It's a whole separate download, and it's got its own space on the hard drive.
Yeah, if that's true, then that would be helpful.
Yeah, because the doesn't go to the same place for your... files, where it stores your personal files and all that stuff for the browser. It's in a totally different place.
All right. Excellent, then. Thank you. Good choice.
If he's familiar with that browser, it's pretty much the same other than it stores nothing, you know.
Right. Okay, good.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
Yep.
How about, that's a good choice, then.
Yeah, if it will work for him, that would be great.
Yep. Generally speaking, for all browsers, private means keeping data off of your machine. It doesn't make you private on the internet.
Hey, James, hold on.
And you can tell that because they still know who you are when you go to their website. You log into them. Mm-hmm. How can you be private if you've logged in?
You're only private
on your machine.
You're protecting it from other people who might have physical access to your machine.
Yep.
And you're not protecting yourself from other people out on the internet or other websites.
Right. Exactly.
Or the companies that run them.
Exactly. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. Hi, James, what's up?
Oh, hi, Nick. First of all, Dave does an excellent job on the phone, as always.
Doesn't he?
Yeah, perfect.
How much is he paying you?
I think we'll keep him.
Yeah, he's great. Quick question for you on the sea cleaner that I'm getting ready to run. If I check off the cookies, will that make it so next time, does that erase my login information next time I go to the website and passwords and everything?
Yes. Well, it depends. There's if you erase the cookies from that website, then yes. It is very possible it will erase all the data, including the fact that you've already logged in and you're okay. So you would have to log in again. Now, on top of that, there is the fact that you may have saved the password in some sort of password manager, maybe the browser's password manager or your own separate one.
Or Google or something.
Right, and that would would put the password back in for you.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about. When you go to the website, it loads your password.
Yep. Okay. So it depends on where that's coming from as to whether or not CCleaner's cookie will erase that.
Yeah, I was looking on the CCleaner, and they got so many settings to check off: cookies, internet history, cache, and then that's for Microsoft Edge. Then they have Edge Chromium, Internet Explorer, Windows Explorer, and all that stuff.
Right. Because they're all separate programs.
Yeah, keep it as simple as possible and also do a general cleaning.
Right.
Because I guess it helps. I haven't done it in about 4 months.
It's not a bad thing to do every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do recommend it then, now and then.
Yeah. Now,
okay,
and again, pick what you want to get. Pick what you want to get rid of. I mean, if you haven't even loaded Firefox, you don't need to delete its cookies. But generally speaking, you know, pick the things you don't want to keep and get rid of them every few months or so.
Yeah, I use Chrome, but I have a second one, Firefox, on my machine.
Yep, there you go. All right.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, James. CCleaner is a pretty good program. It's got a lot of options. We suggest that when you run it, you pay attention to what you're checking. It's a, you know, with great power, et cetera, et cetera. But you do get great power with CCleaner, so you do have a lot of responsibility for what you manage. But it lets you do an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
An awful lot. It's great. Okay. Oh, I should. We don't have anybody waiting, do we?
Mm-mm.
I should read this one. This is, you know, we've talked for years about 5 years of mean time between failure.
Sure.
On hard drives.
Now, I do have one announcement to make.
Oh, make the announcement, please. Important.
Okay. Now, we all know that today is March 25th.
And today is March 25th.
Nine months before Christmas.
You beat me to it, Dave. Only 9 shopping months left, so.
You can both shut up right now.
Be sure to get your lists together.
Shut up. Shut up. Is it December? No. Does the date start with a 2? No. I don't have to do any shopping yet.
That's weird that I picked that out because I just saw it this morning. Somebody was talking about it. Oh, gee, 9 months more before Christmas.
That's right. We're 25% of the way around the clock.
Oh,
here.
Ship.
All right, all of you. Forget it. Okay, so back to the news.
That's news.
Get your
Christmas shopping started early.
It's something. It is a four-letter word, but I don't believe it's news.
Uh-oh.
All right, so an analysis of 2007 damaged or defective hard disk drives has led a data recovery firm to conclude that, in general, old drives seem more durable and resilient than new drives. And now, pay attention. We're talking about spinning hard drives only. This does not apply to SSD, solid-state drives.
You said HDD.
I did, but make people aware that this is the spinny drives, the mechanical hard drives.
We're clarifying.
Yes, educating the listener.
Right. The statements come from a Los Angeles-headquartered data recovery firm, aptly named Secure Data Recovery.
Okay.
It has been in business since 2007. and claims to have resolved more than 100,000 cases. It studied the hard drives it received in 2022. Most of those drives were in the 40 gigabyte to 10 terabyte range. Secure Data Recovery broke down the hard drives it received for data recovery by engineer-verified power on hours, or the total amount of time the drive was actually functional, starting from when its owner began using it and ending when the device arrived at Secure Data Recovery. The firm also determines the drive's current pending sector count, depicting the number of damaged or unusable sectors the hard drive developed during routine read and write operations. The company's data does not include hard drives that endured non-predictable failures or damage by unexpected events, such as electrical surges, malware, natural disasters, and accidental mishandling.
All right, so this is just death from natural causes.
Death from natural causes. Notably, almost 75% of the hard drives came from either Western Digital or Seagate, which Secure Data Recovery noted those two companies accounted for 80% of hard drive shipments in 2021.
Okay.
The average time before failure among the sample size was 2 years and 10 months. Although the 2007 defective hard drives had an average of 1,548 bad sectors. Secure Data Recovery said that 37% of the Western Digital and Seagate drives analyzed featured SMR, or shingled magnetic recording, which increases storage density and overall storage capacity. They said SMR-equipped drives resulted in anywhere from 10 to 20% shorter lifespans. Note that these data are for spinning or mechanical hard drives only. Solid-state drives or SSDs are not included in this study and still seem to have a mean time before failure of 5 years. So how are your hard drives? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And this goes along with what I've seen anecdotally. I've got some 10-year-old spinning drives that are great. I stick them on a Raspberry Pi or whatever. They run like tops all day long.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple that I pulled out of machines that are a year old, 2 years old. They're already starting to grind. They're already starting to be slow. They're already starting to have problems.
Well, again, it's all due to manufacturing. I mean, I can remember back in the 90s, we ran into a period where we were ordering Western Digital drives, and I ordered maybe 15 in, you know, to have them stockpiled, and we pulled them off, and we'd get them set up in machines, and they were dying left and right.
Yep.
Dying so bad, I finally said, no, and we packed them all up, sent them all back, ordered Seagates, and, you know, because they keep trying to sell us, well, we got this great deal on Western Digital. No, not until you guys, you know, and that company figures out what right. The heck they're doing wrong, because I had one at the time. I was helping Channel 13 get this one particular server back up, weather machine. We got it all set up, went to shut it down because we did an update, had to restart, and it died.
Yep.
And that was like, no, 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 no. We luckily had backed it up to a Seagate just to cover my butt. So darn good I did, because we were able to quick hot swap that out, put this back in, and yeah, no, I couldn't afford it, because Western Digital, whether, you know, they were going to some other cheap manufacturer or, you know, granted, all hard drives are set up for, say, even a, let's go 1 terabyte. Even though they'll start it out as 1 terabyte, and they might have to progressively move it down in value depending on how it tests out. So they might mark it, you know, maybe, oh, a 750 instead, or a 500.
Right.
They still get some material out of that. But again, it's, you know, materials. And that's the whole problem now, is things are getting done so cheap.
Right. They're making them cheaper, and so they're not
disposable.
Lasting as long.
Yeah, disposable.
So my suggestion to all of you is, if you are building your own machine, go solid state. Every time I buy a laptop, I buy a solid state drive for it if it doesn't have one already. And I just take out the hard drive, put in the solid state drive, and I'm done. I don't have to worry about it. First, it boots up in 8 seconds. as opposed to 2.5 minutes. And secondly, it's going to last me a lot longer.
Well, that's what I just did with the newest machine that I just got from Dell. You know, it came with a, I forget how, spinning drive. Oh, heck no. As soon as that came in, I already had a 2 terabyte SSD drive set for it. I pulled it up, put that in, set it up, got it going. And like you say, fast processor and that, why not have a fast hard drive in it?
Well, exactly.
You know,
and depending on what you're using it for, I put a 240 in this one, and it's still empty. I mean, I'm using it here at the show. I'm not right. using it for other stuff at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's more than adequate amount. I could have done, I could have done with a 120 gig drive and still had half the space empty.
Well, and there are other advantages too. You know, when you don't have something spinning, you don't have to have a motor running to spin it. Even if you're sitting there thinking about what you're going to type next into your, you know, great American novel or your next email, there has to be electricity to keep that drive spinning. And the also you have issues with dust, with vibration, with accidental droppage, et cetera, that spinning drives are much more susceptible to damage when you have those types of environments.
One of the things we did many, many years ago was we swapped out all the laptop hard drives for drives that had auto park.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Automatically parked the cylinder. Heads.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because as you moved the laptop around, it would bounce. And that read head would sometimes make contact with the hard drive surface.
Crash it.
Which would cause a head crash. So they had to be parked. And nobody was going to remember to run a program to do that. And the auto run at shutdown was a little flaky in Windows.
Mm-hmm.
I say was because it still is. But
Mitch Hedberg there.
Yeah. Right. But now with solid state drives, that all goes away. You don't have to worry about that at all.
Yeah, I remember for a while Apple they were using an actual accelerometer inside the machine.
Yes.
They're like, if it fell off the counter before it hit the ground, they were trying to park the heads before it hit the ground in the sub-second amount of time that they had to do that.
But that costs a lot of money. Of course, you paid for that, not Apple. But that costs money to do.
It's true.
And now it's just replace that all with a solid-state drive. You're done.
Right.
Yeah, it's a much better deal as far as that's concerned, and
also lighter. I mean, uses less electricity. It's lighter. It's more durable. It's more stable. It's faster. I'd say even if you have to retrofit it into your existing laptop, it's definitely worth the time.
Yeah, I don't really ever want to buy another.
Helps your battery last longer.
Right, I don't ever want to buy another spinning hard drive. I do not. Solid state is absolutely the way to go, and they last as long as regular drives, as long as the good regular drives, I should say. And so, there's no reason not to use the solids. And they're cheap now. Jeez and crackers, they're cheap now.
Now, if all of this hard drive talk really excites you, you should also check into a company named Backblaze, because they are a place that does online backups, but they have warehouses full of server racks that are full of spinning drives and SSDs, and they keep track of which ones fail over time. And they use more in a year than you would ever use in a lifetime. And they can look at really large things. So check out Backblaze. Look for their annual drive reports to learn more.
Yeah, check it out. All right. That's it. We are done for another week.
It's true.
I want to thank Dave Enright, because it says so right here. I want to thank Dennis Worcester coming in, doing yeoman service.
Happy
Steve Ray,
here.
Of course, somewhere in the Southwest, one step ahead of the law as he launches illegal rockets into the stratosphere.
No, I'm sure they're fully legal.
I'm Nick Francesco. I want to thank everybody who called in, everybody who participated in the chat. We are done, but we'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Sound Bites, and that's right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we remain member supported Jazz 90.1. We'll see you in 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?